Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. My guest today is Gabe Glynn, co-founder and CEO of Make You Safe, a startup focused on improving workplace safety. Gabe also hosts the Advanced Manufacturing Podcast. Gabe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on.
So you're from Iowa.
I am.
And you have many family members who are involved in manufacturing. One of the things that surprised me most when I was researching Iowa, I've never been to Iowa before today.
Welcome.
Thank you. Is actually Iowa is a manufacturing hub. 25%, I think it is, of the GDP of Iowa is from manufacturing. Your family is involved in manufacturing. What is the culture of manufacturing?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that you discovered is just how prevalent it is here in Iowa. And I think to think about the culture of manufacturing, you really need to take a step back in time. You know, with my podcast, when I go out and interview folks in manufacturing, oftentimes what I hear is a story of a company that was started in the 1800s here in Iowa. And it was started as a blacksmithing shop where the people made horseshoes. And here they are five generations later making automated touchscreen grain sorting systems, right? So just a tremendous amount of evolution over the course of time in this industry, in this state, and really here in the Midwest. And what I find interesting is each generation and each change in the ecosystem and the way that we develop products, I think really shifts and changes the workforce and the manufacturing culture. So when you go back to my father in his early days, he was a machinist for 23 years at a facility in Cedar Rapids that made large-scale printing presses for the newspaper industry. And I remember just the casual, fun atmosphere that they had there. It was very, I would say, laid back. I mean, they did a lot. They played practical jokes on each other. They had games shooting things in the warehouse with their tools. You know, it's things like that that was kind of the culture. And now things are becoming a lot, I would say, tighter, a lot more automation, a lot more focus on safety, and a much heavier focus, I think, on productivity and just output. A lot of the factories that I get a chance to go into now, it's very much so an assembly process. You know, not so much an assembly line anymore, but an assembly process as products work through. So I think that's some of the shift that we've seen.
So what's the same thing? What's the common element between making horseshoes and making precision tools? Why is one family doing that? Those two things, but continuously over several generations.
Yeah, I think part of it is just the necessity of change. I spoke with one company, a company called Thombert, and Thombert makes polyurethane wheels for fork trucks. And when they started the company 60 years ago or so, they were making church pews. Hmm. And I go, how do you make the leap from church pews to polyurethane wheels? Because I wasn't able to draw a logical conclusion. They said, well, you use the same tools to make both. So you sculpt wood with these tools, and then as there again factories became more automated, you had more trucks, fork trucks, and things like that driving around. They discovered that they could shape wheels with those same tools, and so that's how they got into that. They don't make church pews anymore, and they make things like roller coaster wheels and stuff like that too. So I think you see that evolutionary change. That's brought on by necessity. It just forces that innovation.
So maybe one common element there is the use of tools. And so manufacturing might be
the people that like to use tools to make things or do things with them. You know, one observation, at least in my experience, limited experience with manufacturing, is there aren't any women. So it's an inherently masculine kind of culture. I don't know if in your journeys around the country interviewing people, have you encountered many women in manufacturing? Probably not.
No, I actually have. Most recently, there was a company I visited, Sucup Manufacturing, here in Iowa, Sheffield, Iowa. And Sucup, they make grain bins, among many other things. And what we're seeing right now with the labor shortage for manufacturing workers, you know, when I say labor shortage, it is really tight. Mm-hmm. Ames, Iowa, just was announced as the lowest unemployment rate in the country, 1.5%.
Wow.
Right? There's just not available workers out there. And so you're getting some non-traditional workers. And the other thing that we're seeing too, David, is as automation happens in facilities and we're using more robotics and more high-tech machines, it doesn't require that use of hands. You said use of tools, right? And I think that's right. I think initially in my mind I was thinking the use of hands, but it's really shifting away from that to being, you know, people that can run computer programs, that can run robotics, that can run automation lines. And really that's something that both men and women can do very, very equally.
I imagine that will have had an effect, because one of the reasons why the gender gap there came to my mind was hearing your stories of the kind of games that were played in your father's in your father's facility.
Yeah.
There, those are very masculine kind of games, right?
Yeah.
And there's this trend out there, or one of the things that's talked about in the commentary ad or whatever you want to call them is our society is becoming less kind of overtly masculine in some ways. And I don't want to take that, kind of overdo that, or do that, or put that the wrong way. But imagining a workplace where there is you know, war games or fighting kind of games being done for fun, I just can't see. I can imagine that today, right?
Sure.
I can imagine that when I was a kid, right?
Yep.
But not necessarily that was happening when I was a kid, but as a kid when I was playing it, boys being boys kind of thing. But today, that's not done.
Yeah, I mean, society and culture, I think, has shifted. When we talk about workplace decorum and how people are supposed to act when they're at work, and that's no different in a manufacturing facility. In fact, I think in some ways it becomes a little bit more important sometimes than a more white-collar setting, right? Because at the end of the
day,
it is. You know, you want these people to go home from work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that tends to be the focus. But, you know, when you talk about women in manufacturing and women in the workforce, you know, a quick little story for you. So I'm from the city of Ankeny, which is a northern suburb of Des Moines here. And our city wouldn't really exist if it wasn't for manufacturing. And that was because during World War II, the government came in and commandeered some land, some farmland around the community. And we were a really, really small community back then. I don't want to put a point on the numbers, but I think it was, you know, 1,500 or something like that. Very small community. They commandeer this land because they're going to make a munitions plant where they're going to make bullets for the war. And the plant was called the Ordnance Plant, and it's still there. It's a John Deere facility now. But the Ordnance Plant made over a billion bullets for World War II. And as you remember, the Rosie the Riveter story, you know, all
sure.
The men were off to war, so all the women ascended on Ankeny to go to work at this factory.
Mm.
And after the war, the factory wasn't needed for manufacturing bullets anymore, thank God. And John Deere came in, bought the facility, and said, we're going to start making John Deere tractors there. Well, you had a pretty high concentration of women in the area. You had a bunch of men coming back from war that were looking for women and starting a family, and they needed jobs, and so that plant really was kind of the lifeblood of what grew Ankeny, and now Ankeny is the fastest growing city in America. We have 5 people a day that are moving in to
wow.
Ankeny. When I moved in there 10 years ago, we were, I think, right around 30,000, and now we're at about 60,000, I think a little over 60,000. So we've doubled in size.
Where are they coming
years.
From?
So all over. You know, I think Des Moines has been getting a lot of accolades lately for being
it's a nice town.
It really is. It's beautiful. And a lot of that change, David, has happened in the last 10 years. I moved to Des Moines
yep.
12 years ago. And when I was growing up in Cedar Rapids on the east side of the state, we called it Des Moines, and nobody wanted to go there. So that change has really happened in the last decade. And, of course, we continue to get the accolades as a great community to raise a family, low cost of living, great for young professionals. The startup community is very vibrant here. And there's limited availability of housing downtown. They're building a lot more, as I'm sure you saw on the skyline as you traveled around town. They're building a lot more loft housing and things like that. But that wasn't here when I got here, 10, 11 years ago. And so we put a stake in the ground in Ankeny, and there's a lot of young families up there.
The unemployment rate, that's pretty amazing. I don't remember the number you said there, but it's low single digits.
Yeah, 1.5.
1.5%, and that's remarkable. And a couple of things there come to mind. One, that the unemployment rate's so low. Two, that the lamentations across the economic state of the United States on how there isn't any manufacturing going on and how people lament that and they don't like that. And that's kind of one thing that always puzzled me, as it seems something of an arbitrary choice. Like, why are you focused on this one sector? Why does that sector matter? And that's kind of one thing that I'd be interested in your thoughts on. But there's an irony here that the place where it is alive and well and strong and growing, there's no people who wants these jobs. So, you know, what's going on? Do you have any idea what's going on there?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there's nobody that wants these jobs. It's just that there's nobody available for the jobs.
Yeah,
right?
Sorry, that's what I should say. Sorry to interrupt you, but
no,
when I say nobody wants these jobs, I think what I mean by that is people aren't willing to move here for them.
From
places where, you know, let's say in the Northeast, where there isn't very much manufacturing, where the land prices are really high, you can't build a giant factory. Why not move to Iowa and you can have these jobs if you want so bad? And it's not happening, it seems.
Yeah, I think a big part of that is the way that we're raising young people now. This mentality of work smart, not hard. And the thought behind manufacturing is that, well, it's got to be dirty, hard, hard labor. And that's really not the case. I mean, in a lot of cases, these facilities are being forced to automate because there's just not a labor force to be able to fill those jobs. In fact, at Sukup Manufacturing that I mentioned earlier, they recently started implementing a lot of automation inside their facility. And even from the time that they started that implementation to the time that I visited them, they had hired like 400 people, which so there's all these people saying, well, don't automate because it'll get rid of all these jobs. Well, they have to, and they're still continuing to hire. So I think part of it is, you know, starting at an early age and letting kids know there's a lot of opportunity in the trades, right? There's a lot of opportunity to do really exciting, fun work. Things like welding. Welding is as much an art as it is work, right? It's, making things with your hands and the joy that comes out of putting an 8-hour day in at a facility where you got to see the product that you built throughout the day go out the door and off to another place for somebody to use. And so I think we need to be focusing on that, especially in the middle school age kids. I think there's a study out there that says by age 14, kids have kind of decided what their path is going to be after high school. And we're not letting them know that there's a lot of opportunity available to go to community college, to trade schools, to learn skills that are high-tech skills, too. I mean, you've got CNC operators. That's running robotics and computers. You've got SolidWorks designers. That's using computers to design things that can be 3D printed and things like that. There's a lot of high technology opportunities in the manufacturing sector. But for some reason, we put this big red X on manufacturing and said, well, you don't want to go work there. You want to go get that 4-year degree and get a white-collar job, and it'll be a much better path for you and your family. And I just don't believe that that's true.
So there's a few puzzles here. So as a society, we still love it, or at least on paper, people talk about it as though they want more of it. And yet, so the last podcast episode I recorded was with Brian Kaplan, who's an economist, who wrote this book called The Case Against Education. And one of the points that he makes there is education is almost entirely devoted to creating good positive signals for about people and not actually about teaching them anything. And Brian, in the book that he wrote, talks about Germany, which has this much more highly advanced vocational education system, so put people into the trades. And one of the questions I asked him was, why can they do it? And what else about German society is different that makes that the case? And his answer, I think, if I remember right, boiled down to something on the lines of, well, for historical accident reasons, it's just not perceived to be as same kind of lower status profession, which I don't know if I get that, because why is it that people have these? Well, they're totally wrong. So think about all the things that we think are wrong about manufacturing. It's almost like the most wrongly thought about profession on earth, right? Because, you know, even the point that I have imparted here today, women aren't part of it. They are, absolutely. And the World War II point you brought up was a great one. Obviously, it was entirely populated by women then, right?
Yep.
So it's not like women can't do it or don't want to do it or can't be good at it. I think that there might be something to boys enjoying making things more, perhaps. I'm not so sure about that. Another one is that they're not white-collar jobs, when, in fact, they very much are. I remember when I was in high school, my first exposure to the trades was I worked for a carpenter when I was doing a co-op at a national park that was near my hometown. And I worked for this carpenter, and he built this was a hut for exhibits on this marshland that was in this park, Point Pelee National Park. And it was amazing how much math he was using and how many problems he was solving. I thought it was really, really interesting and really cool. And it was a deeply, deeply engaging intellectual activity, building something by yourself. You know, tools he was using and designing it properly so the thing stands up, can bear the weight, and he had to calculate how thick the wood had to be. It was an amazing experience. So it's intellectually satisfying. It is anybody can do it, in the sense that men or women, you don't have to be physically strong. Maybe the horseshoe people did.
Sure. Yeah.
Bending horseshoes and hammering things. Perhaps you had to hold a blacksmith, maybe the precursor to manufacturing. And unemployment rate is incredibly low, so the jobs are there. Presumably they pay better than minimum wage. They pay very well. What the hell?
Yeah. In fact, in a lot of cases, kids can go to school for free.
Yeah.
To get these jobs.
Sure.
Because the employers are saying, look, if you'll go to school for 2 years and learn welding or learn to be a CNC operator, we'll pay for that education for you. The opportunities are all right there. I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a cultural thing. I think it's something that and I'm not exactly sure how or where it started. It is. It's a prejudice that started somewhere, where we got this idea that in order to be a successful person or to be a person of status or be accepted by society, you need to go get a four-year education and try to find an office job. The one benefit that you didn't touch on there, David, of manufacturing is the ability to punch out at 5 o'clock and go home to your family, and you left work at work. Right? Mm. You can't operate that CNC from your smartphone.
Yeah.
You're not reading emails. You're not having to deal with all of the extra work, you know, the after hours work, the nights and the weekends, of the silly smartphone that's constantly buzzing and reminding you of what you have to be doing at the office. And that's one of the things that I just really admire about the lifestyle of a manufacturing worker, that ability to say, hey, when I'm here, you get my all from 8 to 5, but at 5 o'clock, my family gets my all. And on Saturdays and Sundays, my family and my church get my all, right? And they can put that focus in. And the rest of us idiots are running around with their smartphone, spending every minute looking at, oh, did I get another email?
I was going to make that point, the observation that, admire it though you might, Gabe, you have not followed that path.
No.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about your own personal history and business and what sort of things you worked on in your career.
So as you mentioned, manufacturing is a big part of my family. It's a big part of our state, the community that I grew up in. Watching my father go into work for 23 years as a machinist, and you know, for the last 15 years, he's been a safety manager at a facility with more than 1,000 employees. That was always a big part of who I was. And I ended up going a different route than many family members, and I kind of went into this route of technology and startups. So about 12 years ago, I started my first startup. It was in the insurance space, and it was actually an idea that my dad had when he was in his early 20s, and he never pursued. And we were camping one day, and he said, you know, I always wanted to start a company where I would go inside, you know, wealthy people's homes, and I would inventory all their personal possessions, and I would keep a record of it, and if they ever had an insurance claim, then I had all of the information for what they had. And I go, that's a darn good idea. And I said, you know what, I think I'm going to pursue that. So I started a company called Asset Protection Specialist, and I did just that. I took video recorders, voice recorders, cameras, that kind of stuff, and we would inventory people's personal assets. And then we database all of it with an online tool. And then if they had an insurance claim, we would just work with the insurance company to provide them all that information. And so that was my first kind of foray into entrepreneurship. And that was 2000. 2006, I think 2006, 2007, right around there.
Were you working before that? Did you have to quit a job to do that?
I did. Right. I was an executive at Target Corporation.
Okay.
So I had gotten into retail. My first job was bagging groceries at the corner grocery store when I was 14, and that's what most of the kids in our neighborhood did. And so I worked my way up to cashier, and then customer service guy, and then shift manager. And
really?
Yeah. And then got into when I was into college. I went to Target Corporation. My older brother had been working there for a while, and he actually still does over in Chicago area. And the job that he was doing was catching shoplifters. Hmm. And I said, that sounds like an interesting job for a college guy, right? So that's what I would do. I would go into work, and I would wear jeans and a T-shirt, and I'd pretend to be a shopper.
Undercover.
And I'd carry a pair of handcuffs, and I would stop people and arrest them if they were stealing. And I caught hundreds of shoplifters over my career. Eventually, I got moved up, and I started running teams of people that were, you know, managing
How do you spot a shoplifter?
It's not a it's nothing about the person themselves. It's about their mannerisms and actions.
Okay.
One of the easiest ways is to just watch for the person that's looking around a lot at things
they
shouldn't
be looking. Yeah, they're nervous.
Exactly.
They're worried about being caught.
Yep. They're looking up at the ceiling where the cameras are, and you know, acting suspiciously,
looking guilty.
And the thing is I mean, I caught kids, you know, stealing Pokemon cards and baseball cards. I caught people in their 80s. Stealing pharmaceuticals and things like that.
Wow.
So, I mean, all across the board. It was really no one demographic of person. It was a fun job. I got a chance to go up in the ranks there at Target. And there again, you know, working 80-hour work weeks, constantly on call, right? If an incident happened in a store where one of our employees were involved in stopping somebody and it turned violent or something like that.
It sounds tough.
It was a challenging job. There's a fine line between protecting assets of a company and protecting the people that are trying to steal it. Right?
Okay.
You never go out there wanting somebody to get hurt.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't just let everybody walk out the door with stuff.
Sure.
It's, you know, each store it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, right, of stuff that goes missing every year. So. That was probably one of the funnest jobs I had. I've got a good friend of mine who's a SWAT officer for the city of Des Moines here, and he and I caught shoplifters together. So we'd go have a beer at night and share
after
our stories.
Bouncing
and,
people.
It was a fun time and an interesting time. But yeah, I walked away from that and decided to start my first business. I had no business background, had no idea what I was doing. And one of my instructors from college in business school helped me start my first company.
So what did you study at college?
Business. So right. I ended up with a business degree.
Okay. So why not manufacturing? So where did you diverge from the manufacturing path that so many people in your family? Was it just something that never really interested you? Did you resent it in some way? You know, everybody else is doing this. Were you a bit of a contrarian in your family and that like that? Why did it not start?
Yeah, I think it was just... I find myself thinking a little bit differently about things. I like to ideate and create, and probably more of an engineering mind. And I think if I would have really applied myself in school, that would have been a better route for me to take, would have been to go and be an electrical engineer, mechanical engineer, and find myself
I feel the same way, by the way.
One of those.
I wish I had done that. Even when I was there, I was like, man, I really wish I could be an engineer, but decided not to do the work to do it.
Exactly.
So I didn't do it.
Yep. I was having fun in college, know, and
me too.
And so, you know, as you grow older, you look back on those things and you go, man, you know, maybe I should have done that. But at the same time, I think about what I'm getting a chance to do now. You know, my life would have been totally different if I would have actually applied myself.
Because you're coming back to manufacturing now, or coming to it, I suppose.
I am.
From your own direction. So maybe talk a little bit about Make You Safe.
Yeah, so really the transition happened after I sold the inventory company in 2010 and started a technology company that dealt with a variety of different software things. But really, with that software company, we were still pretty heavily focused on manufacturing. And so what we discovered was this was kind of the turn of the mobile revolution, David, where everybody started to run around with smartphones and people wanted everything on demand. Well, a lot of these manufacturing facilities had archaic old systems that needed to be upgraded to mobile so that their salespeople in the field could see how many things are in inventory, you know, mm-hmm. when they're out selling, right? So taking ERP systems and making them mobile, there's just a lot of opportunity in manufacturing for technology. And so that's really where I started to get back into the manufacturing side of things. And I grew that company with a friend of mine. We sold that in 2015 to a larger software company that was also doing custom software. And I spent about a year doing the transition with them before I left. And that was at that time that my wife told me to get out of the house and go do something. And I started the podcast on manufacturing. And it was really the podcast that led to Make You Safe. You know, when I started the podcast, it was I wanted to learn a new skill. I wanted to learn broadcast. I wanted to learn audio editing and mixing. And so I went to my church. They were upgrading their audio system at church. They had this old small mix board and some different equipment. And I said, cool, I'll take that off your hands. I'll buy that from you and put it to good use. And so I started the podcast with this idea that I wanted to tell those stories. I wanted people to be able to hear the story of the company that started in the 1800s, and five generations later, they're still making really interesting and cool things. And I figured nobody's going to listen to this, but you know, I'll record it. I'll put it out online with a free license to distribute, to use, to syndicate, whatever they want. And it pretty quickly started to blow up. I started getting thousands of listeners. I started getting people from all over the world calling me and saying, you know, hey, we're a fan of your podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever they heard it, and we're doing something really cool here. Do you want to tell our story? So it gave me a chance to you know, reach out of my circle of people that I knew in manufacturing here in Iowa. And about a year ago at this time, GE Corporation reached out and said, hey, you know, we're fans of your podcast here at GE. We do some innovative things. Sure if you're familiar with us, but yeah. They said, how would you like to join us on a multi-day tour? We'll fly you around the country for a couple of days and show you some of the coolest things we're doing. And they could have told me to just drive to Burlington, Iowa and look at their facility, and I would have been happy to do that. But I took them up on the opportunity. They took me to Detroit to their robotics facility. I went to their jet engine facility in Lafayette, their locomotive engine facility in Pennsylvania. So I got a chance to fly around and see all these different things. And then I sat down for dinner at an oyster bar in Boston with Jeff Immelt before he retired. So all of that because of this hobby podcast. But it was the podcast that really led to Make You Safe, as I mentioned, because one afternoon I was out touring facilities, and one of the facilities I was in, the employees had these funny-looking buttons on their shirt. And I asked the gentleman, I go, what's that all about? And he said, well, I'm being audited by OSHA. One of my employees lost their hearing, and that's called a dosimeter button, and they're going to come back and collect it and download the data off of it and find out if we violated OSHA code. Hmm. I said, well, tell me more about that. You know, what kind of laws and rules and regulations are there around sound, and what about the other things in the environment that impact them? You know, heat, humidity, air quality, those kinds of things. How do you guys monitor them? And what I discovered was really an outdated, archaic process of how we make sure that the environment that our workers work in, and not just in manufacturing, I mean, this is in all areas, but how do we make sure that that environment is healthy, safe, and productive for those workers? And so that was kind of the genesis of Make You Safe, and contacted my friend Mark at the time, who was working at IBM, and I said, hey, I think I've got a really good idea on how we could make a significant impact on worker health and safety and productivity. And what I want to do is create a device that we can put on people that monitors all the environmental conditions around them and will notify guys like my father when people get close to that violating threshold, right? Let's not wait until the damage has been done to their hearing, or you know, somebody's having chest and breathing problems because the air quality is bad. Let's not wait until it gets to that point to do something about it. And really the exciting thing is as we gather more and more data and we learn more and more about the environments around these people, we can use machine learning and analytics to be able to identify the trends in the data that are showing us that risk is starting to emerge, right? So we can really try to get to a place where we're preventing these things from happening before they do.
So we met at a InsurTech event in San Jose, and you told the story of your company to a group of insurance, reinsurance industry folks, and I was in the audience. And I have one of the ways I like to think about innovation in insurance is there actually isn't such a thing as innovation in insurance. There's only innovation in risk management. And people in the insurance industry, I think, get distracted a little bit by what they do every day, which is insurance. And they forget that the social value of what we're doing is insulating people from risk. And the only way to really affect insurance is to affect the risk, to change the risk. And what I loved about your product and your idea was that not only were you not an insurance person, but you weren't even focused on insurance. You're focused on actually the risk, which is what we miss so often in our business. And that's why I was very excited to get to know you a little bit and to learn more about the product. And we're going to be learning more about the product. And I think that ultimately it is through innovations like this that really you can change something like the insurance industry.
Yeah, and to your point, when we started this journey, it wasn't about insurance for us. It was about how do we make sure that the environment these people are working in is as safe and productive as it can possibly be. And what I kept hearing over and over again from the factory owners that I was talking to about this concept, and we were beta testing some of our early devices and facilities, is we kept hearing over and over again, we want to know this information.
Yep.
That was my first question, was do you want to know, or do you want that plausible deniability? Like, sure. Sorry, I didn't know that.
OSHA turns up, you're like, I didn't know.
I didn't realize it. But what I kept hearing over and over again was, we're still responsible for that environment, whether we know about it or not.
Yep.
So why be negligent, and why look silly and not knowledgeable when there's a tool out there that will help us identify that and help us do what we need to make a change in the facility? And so that was our primary focus, was sending more people home from work every day. When we started doing research, one of the heartbreaking statistics we came across was more than 1,000 people a day die in work accidents on this planet. So that means since I started this company, more than 500,000 people have not gone home to their families at the end of the day. And we believe that with data like this, we're going to be able to send more people home from work. And that's our driving factor. It wasn't till the old adage, right, follow the money, that that we really kind of fell into the lap of the insurance companies, as we were starting to be able to prove out that with this type of data and the way that we're analyzing things and the types of things that we're looking at, we can help make an impact on that risk. That was kind of the aha moment for the connection between us and the insurance companies.
So this is your second dalliance with the insurance industry. How did it end the first time? In working with insurance companies, taking pictures of stuff, how did that go? Did you engage with them? Did you find a response? Are you happy to be back in bed with insurance? Or was this like, oh, no, not those guys again?
Well, it was a totally different level, right? So the first company, it was more at the agent level. You know, every insurance agent tells their clients, you know, go home and do an inventory of your property and put it in a safe place. You know, don't keep it in the same house, because if the house burns down, you know, you're going to lose it. So we would go in and we would say, hey, here's the deal. Here's our brochure. You're going to tell them to do that. You know they're not going to do that, but let them know there's a service out there that can do that. And what I'll do for you is at the end of the inventory, I'll provide you a copy of that inventory, and I'll pay for coffee for you and your customer to sit down and go through. Because what we discovered was about 90% of my clients were underinsured on their property. You know, they didn't understand the ins and outs of an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I set out to do early on with that company, was I wanted to become an expert in that area, because that's the area that I was trying to help them in. So I met with retired claims adjusters. I met with insurance agents. I read dozens of policies from different companies. And what people didn't realize was there's limits of liability within a policy. So yeah, they have $500,000 contents coverage on the contents of their house. But by the way, that guitar collection you have, musical instruments is only covered up to $1,500.
Yep.
So that $30,000 worth of guitars you have, they're not going to be covered if something happens to them. And so that provided the insurance agent the opportunity to find those things and give better coverage to the people. So it was really a win-win situation. What we're dealing with now is much larger. It's much more at the carrier level. We do see a little bit more of the slow movement of the industry and some of the red tape and things. But what I have been pleasantly surprised by is the reception to what we're doing. I think insurance as an industry right now recognizes that 5 years from now, insurance is going to look very, very different. You know, some of the companies that I've been seeing out there where you literally buy on-demand insurance. You know, you're going to go jump out of an airplane, you turn on this insurance for the next 25 minutes. Once you hit the ground, you turn it off. You know, they do it with travel too. You hop on an airplane, you turn on your insurance, you turn it off. You're flying a drone, you turn on the insurance while you're flying it. When you land it, you turn it off. So there's just a lot of things in that industry that are ripe for change. But there wasn't a lot of focus on risk reduction, right? It's all about delivery of products. And so I think that's what made us a little bit more appealing and unique.
So maybe it's worth talking a bit about the product itself. What is it physically? What exactly does it do? What stage of the development is it at?
Yeah. So really, as I mentioned in the beginning, it was all inspired by sound. And so we knew we wanted to at least monitor sound. And we wanted to do it in the way that a dosimeter would do it, right? There's certain requirements by OSHA. This time-weighted average of certain decibel levels of certain frequencies. It's a pretty complex algorithm. And so we knew that out of the gate we wanted to do that. We also wanted to gather some of the other, you know, more ubiquitous environmental conditions that you'll see in a variety of different facilities, right, the temperatures and those kinds of things. Because an employee, they have something called heat protocol in a facility, for example. An employee can only be exposed to so much heat, and then after that period, they go to a 30 minutes on and a 5 minute water break. 30 minutes on, 5 minute water break, right? And a lot of these facilities have a thermostat on the wall that's, you know, 200 feet away from this person that's working between two machines, and where they're working, it's 107 degrees, but the thermostat says it's 89 degrees. So they're not getting that heat protocol that the company knows is beneficial to that person. So we said we have to take these sensors and we have to put all this stuff on the individual and really personalize that individual's environment, personalize that individual's safety from the environment. And so that was really kind of the innovative side of things. So we're gathering a variety of environmental factors and conditions. And then we're also automating and streamlining near-miss reporting. So that was the other piece that we wanted to solve was, in our research, we found out that the number one way to prevent an accident in a facility is to get the employees to report the almost accidents,
right,
or near misses, as they're called. But 80 to 90% of those are estimated to go unreported. And we did research and interviewed employees, and our findings corresponded with what OSHA found too, which the number one reason employees don't want to report the accident is they don't want to stop their work and fill out a 15-minute piece of paperwork on a form for an accident that didn't even happen.
Don't blame them.
Right? Especially as we talked earlier about the emphasis on quantity and productivity, right? And they have to hit their numbers, you know? And so we said, well, what if we could streamline that into a process that automatically detects some of these kinds of things, or makes it so the employee can simply talk into a device and it knows who they are, where they are, when it is. And
is that what's on the form, just kind of where it is and what it is, basic information?
Yeah, there's a lot of basic information. And the other side of it, too, is once you gather this kind of information, the process for what you do with it really isn't standardized, right? So what I see is I go to these facilities and you've got maybe 20 reports from this month. And you've got a safety team and a safety director, and they go into a boardroom and they lay these 20 forms out.
Pieces of paper. My God.
You know, in some cases, they've got tablets that they have people fill out, and then they can print off a report. But they lay these things out, and they go, all right, guys, let's find the patterns in this stuff.
Well, that's a giant square.
Exactly.
Paper.
Exactly. So,
wow, unbelievable. That's amazing. That's amazing.
And so the amount of data that we're gathering is not something that any human can really lay out on a table and parse. We did a beta test at a small facility here in Altoona, Iowa, last year. We put five of our devices on five employees for 6 weeks, and we gathered over 7 million data points in that time. And that's way too much data for anybody to digest. But the platform side of things is really where the magic happens, right? You've got the analytics, the charts and the graphs and things like that, which are fine, and they help you recognize some of those trends. But we took it a step further and said, let's implement machine learning, right, the artificial intelligence side of things here, to read this data and try to identify what are the high-risk trends that are going on within this data, and try to identify what are the things that are going to likely have the most impact on the company's bottom line and on claims and on, you know, people being out of work.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, I think, the focus.
The biggest challenge in any insurance rating algorithm is getting the right exposure. So exposure in this case being what is the denominator under which you put claims. So, you know, how many times does somebody trip over? Like the example you gave in the talk that I where I met you was, you can sense potentially somebody tripping over something that's a crack in the floor or something like that 6 times, and the 7th time somebody falls down and breaks their arm or something or hurts themselves, and there's an exposure there which you can measure if you have the right tools, but it doesn't exist yet. Right?
Exactly.
Well, what are the different sensors that are sitting inside this device? There's heat, there's sound.
Yeah, there's a variety. We don't go too much in detail about all the things that we're sensing right now. We're still in the early stages of the company. The product is set to release later this year as we kind of go through this new product introduction process. We've got all of the engineering done. We're testing with our production style devices. We're now going through the contract manufacturing phase of things. But it's just a variety of environmental conditions. One of the things we wanted to avoid, David, was the HIPAA covered stuff, right? A lot of people ask us, are you tracking heart rate, blood pressure? Are you tracking how many bathroom breaks people take? All of those kinds of things. Yeah. and we said a couple of reasons why we wanted to avoid that stuff. One, we don't want employees to have a reason to not want to participate with this, right?
Right, no downside
so
for them.
If we make it about the environment and really what's going on around them and what's impacting them, but also impacting their coworkers, there's a lot of incentive for them to want to have a system like this to help ensure that they're going home at the end of the day and that they're getting the proper, you know, care based on the environmental factors that they're being exposed to. And then the other thing is we didn't want to deal with who owns this data, right? And there's a lot of question around, can employers be requesting data from employees that is covered by HIPAA, right? Can you actually ask your employee to provide their heart rate? Can you ask the employee to wear something that understands their brain waves or stress levels or things like that? So we said, let's just avoid all that junk. Let's focus on what's going on in the environment around them, which we know has a tremendous impact on that worker, and let's start there.
Mm-hmm. How has the reception been to this amongst manufacturing facilities and companies?
Yeah, it's been tremendous. So not only at the C-suite level of these manufacturing facilities, right? They're trying to make sure that their workers are safe. They've got a lot of incentive to make sure that their workers stay there and work. And it's not just about productivity, right? If you have a catastrophic loss in a facility, there's the initial costs, and typically those are covered by the insurance company, right? But then you have the collateral damage, and the collateral damage is estimated to be 4 to 5 times more costly.
Really?
That's your employees that witnessed the accident happen that now need other type of care. They need to be off work. They can't be in there anymore. They maybe decide that they don't want to work at the company anymore because of the bad memories, and now you've got to try to find new employees and hire and train. Certainly, the company perception, right, when a catastrophic accident happens, especially in a small community, it's all over the newspaper, right? The damage to the brand, as I mentioned earlier, it's hard enough to find people to come and work in these facilities. You don't want somebody being out of work, and you certainly don't want to lose somebody because it's going to be that much harder for you and that much more costly to get people back to work.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the entrepreneurial process. So you started this company a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
is that right?
We're about two years in. Yeah,
2 years
coming
in.
Up in May.
And how has it been? What's it like being an entrepreneur? Stressful.
It is, and this journey is totally different than any of my past experiences. Right. Part of it is because of the magnitude of what we're doing.
Okay.
The challenges behind what we're doing. I didn't have any experience with hardware when I started this. And so my ignorance from the outside was, how hard can it be, right? It can't be that much different than building a complex piece of software. It is tremendously hard. Mm. And it is tremendously
hard about
capital
it?
Intensive. There's a lot of challenges around a device working properly and doing what you want it to do. There's a lot of areas for it to break. And the difference between software and hardware is when something in software isn't working, it only costs you time, right? You just got to find out what it is and you got to fix it.
Right.
With hardware, if you've created an iteration of your hardware and you get it out into the field and something fails on it, you have to now re-engineer that. And that costs a tremendous amount of money to do. And so I wasn't prepared for the capital intensity of a project like this. I didn't have any background in running a corporate board of directors. My other businesses have been LLCs, you know, one or two member LLCs, pass-through entities. So, you know, corporate board of directors, I had never raised outside capital before. I had only heard about it. I'd only seen other people do it. I've only watched, you know, the movies and the shows and that kind of stuff. So I really didn't know what I was getting into with the fundraising side of things. There's just so many things, David, that thankfully I was ignorant, because if I would have made a list of the pros and the cons, or the stuff that I had and the stuff that I didn't have, I would have made this huge list and I would have said, man, I'm not the right person to do this. I have no idea. But we got, my partner Mark and I, we got a year into this thing. We had multiple beta versions of the device out. We've been running the corporation. We went through patenting. We had raised several rounds of capital at that point. We had done a lot of those things, and we looked at what the road to the finish line is here when we get to release the product, and we said, that's still a lot of work to get there. But man, I think we can do it. We have all the pieces now. We've got all the right people in place. We've got a lot of partners in place. We've learned a lot along the way. So it's just been a totally different journey and one that I wasn't prepared for. And I think a really big chunk of that is on the capital raising side of things. Mm-hmm. That's
all you're doing. Your time.
It really is.
I would think.
It is a full-time job. I was smart enough to go out and talk to folks that have done this before, that have raised capital and tried to get an idea of what to expect. You've gotten to know me a little bit here. You know, I'm a voracious reader and listener of podcasts and things like that. So I went out there and I got all the books and I got online and I tried to absorb as much as I could and prepare myself as much as I could before I actually went out there and started raising the capital. I didn't want to make, you know, mistakes. And part of that is finding a good CPA, finding a good attorney, finding, you know, surrounding yourself with some good advisors that have experience in doing this. And that's made a lot of the difference. You know, we've been able to raise three rounds of capital, you know, thus far, and just learning a lot along the way. It's been pretty cool.
Are there any components of the initial vision or thought of what this could be that were just totally wrong that you've had to pivot in the term of art?
You know, I don't know if there's anything that I would say was totally wrong. One of the biggest evolutions was really when we started to engage with the insurance industry. We really changed our focus of how do we deliver this product. Initially, we were doing deals and kind of laying the groundwork for safety equipment distributors, right? We had more than 50 safety equipment distributors around the world that wanted to sell our products. And that was kind of the initial direction that we were looking at going. Once we realized that there is a lot of incentive for insurance carriers to offer something like this as a value add, we said, wow, that's really the direction that we should take the company.
So it wasn't what you hadn't thought of insurance companies at first?
No, that wasn't even really on our radar. There again, I mean, going back to it, we were really focused on guys like my dad. You know, how do we make their lives better? Really, we were kind of forced into the hardware side of things. What we wanted was to create an analytics platform that helped identify the issues and then offered them the remediation steps, right? So not only do we identify what the problem is, but then provide them the remediation steps to overcome that. The problem was there wasn't anything on the planet Earth that existed that gathered the kind of data that we wanted to.
Yeah.
And so there again, necessity forces innovation.
So there's a hub model here, right, where you have these devices that people carry around or, I guess, are attached to their body somehow, and that transmits a bunch of information to a piece of software, which then analyzes it and then issues reports. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So there's a couple components. On the hardware side, you've got the devices themselves. And so it's an armband device where there's a core, as we call it, which is the piece that contains all of the electronics and the technology, and that clips into an armband. We wanted something that was not on the hand and wrist. A lot of facilities don't allow hand and wrist jewelry. We didn't want something that would get caught, you know, on the machine. It'd be really horrible if your safety device was the reason why you got injured, right?
Yep.
So a lot of thought went into that. We went through, I think, 9 different design iterations to come up with what we're working with now. But yeah, and then all of that All of those cores go into a base station, as we call it. So it's, imagine kind of like a kiosk or like an ATM that has 20 slots in it, and all these cores go in there. So an employee comes, they check out a core by entering their employee ID, and it assigns a device to them. And it now knows that that device is now connected to David for the mm-hmm. for the day. So he goes on throughout his day, throughout his work, and it's constantly sending data back to that base station via a mesh network. And then it sends that data to the cloud. And then at the end of the day, that employee can go to any base station in the facility, pop the device back in, and it automatically checks it back in and charges it for them. Mm-hmm. So that's on the hardware side of things. Then the software side of things, our platform is called Make You Smart. And so the idea behind that was, let's provide the analytics and visuals, right, for the data that we're gathering to help people see some of these trends. But let's add a machine learning layer that really dives deep into this data and helps identify things for them. And once we identify those high-risk trends, let's provide them remediation steps to be able to overcome what these challenges are. Instead of forcing them to go out and try to do research on their own and see what resources are available, we provide a lot of those resources directly through the platform.
So you're a hardware and a software company, and only one company springs to mind that's very successful at both simultaneously. I don't know if it emboldens you or terrifies you because it's the biggest company in the world, but I don't know where the second one is, that being Apple that I'm talking about. I think being really good at both of those things at the same time is pretty hard.
It is. It presents some challenges, but I like to look at us more as a software and data company. We built our platform to be really device agnostic, right? So we can take in other types of sensors. There are other startup companies out there that are working on products that have said, you know, we don't want to invest the time and the money to try to build out our own platform. If you guys are successfully deploying this out into facilities, could we just focus on building really good hardware and put it on your platform? And there's a lot of other things that are already in place in facilities, right? Building automation systems, HVAC systems, all of these things are internet enabled now. Mm. And so to tie those things back into our platform to allow some automation even of those remediation steps, right? When we know it's too humid in one area, let's dry out the air. When we know it's too hot in one area, let's cool it down. Some of those kinds of things we can do automatically through the platform.
And another thing that came to mind here is that you are in the manufacturing business now. You're making these devices, or you're making prototypes of these devices. How about thinking back to the podcasts now that you've hosted? Do you have a new kind of, appreciation for what people go through who make things? Because now you're making things.
Yeah, it's significantly more complex than I had expected.
Right.
Now, granted, we're working with consumer grade electronics, right? Yep. So electronic components. I got a chance to
visit. Kill you.
No. I got a chance to visit a board house where they make the printed circuit boards, PCBs, and then they do all the surface mounting and everything. And it was just fascinating to see the types of equipment and things that they do to make circuitry. Probably changed significantly over the years. But yeah, I do have a newfound respect for that.
Anything about it which is maybe harder than you thought would have been? If you don't know much about it, I suppose everything is. But
yeah, really the biggest thing is not making a mistake and having to revisit design, right? You have to be really careful about the tolerances. We're working with things that are really tiny, right? And we're putting them all together, and there has to be enough space for certain things, and there are certain things that you don't want space for, and all of that kind of stuff. And we're working with a pretty sharp team of engineers to make sure that once we get to the place where we go, all right, let's start, instead of making tens of these things, let's make tens of thousands of these things, you got to make sure that you got it right at that point before you do it, because the cost of creating a bunch of devices and then finding out something doesn't work right and you have to re-engineer and then retool and go back to it, that could be the difference between success and failure. I mean, one mistake could easily take the company down.
So you're the creative guy on this team. Do you find that you clash with the need for the precision and the care that need goes into? And I think back to the original question I asked on manufacturing culture, I think of it as a culture of precision in some ways, right? So things need to be exactly right. And you don't appreciate, Mr. Creative, what I mean by that yet, do you? And you've learned that. What do you think about that idea?
You know, I think it's fair to say that I've surrounded myself with the people that that are able to manage a lot of those things that free me up to focus on the business side of things. Where my creative juices get flowing is when we start to talk about how we solve the problems for our customers, right? How we identify ways to continue to improve their processes, whether that's working with an insurance company or whether that's working with the end user. And I leave the hard technical engineering things to my engineering partners to be able to deal with. So I'll let them sweat over those things, and I'll just focus on the other things.
You, at the end of the day, you might wander down the hall and say, hey, guys, I got a new idea. And they like, put their head in their hands, like, oh, gaze back. Does that happen, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. It's always happening, right? You have a parking lot of things that you know, eventually you want to get to. And I mean, we're pretty hyper-focused on a few areas, right? Manufacturing, logistics, and commercial agriculture with our current products. The patents that we have are other areas as well, using other types of technology, right? We recognize there's a lot of other verticals that could be touched by this type of technology. And so it's sometimes hard to see the opportunity in those other places and say, okay, all right, I got to stay focused on what we're doing. We need to get this flagship product out. We need to make sure that we get the market penetration that we need. And then let's use those funds to help us do R&D on some of these other things. But Make You Safe as a company, so spelled M-A-K-U-S-A-F-E. Well, Maku is Hawaiian for risk. And so we pronounce it Make You Safe. We put a line over the A and pronounce the company Make You Safe. But really, we're a safety technology company with a focus on sending more people home from work every day. And we have a variety of other ideas and technologies and applications for the things that we're doing that we'll be excited to be able to explore down the road too. So I see Make You Safe as being more than just a, you know, one piece of hardware, you know, one trick pony kind of thing. We have a lot of other ideas, but really the biggest thing was building out this core suite of software to be able to manage all of that kind of stuff and be able to deliver actionable items and processes to people, to the end user.
How have you been able to, or have you been able to, balance the rest of your life? Because you're a passionate guy. This is clearly such an interesting business and an idea which is clear to me anyway that it's a good one, and you're validating it, and so you must feel enormously excited and I don't know, vindicated in kind of a deep way that, man, this thing's actually happening. That's got to be an intoxicating feeling, right? And absolutely. Yet you have your father, right? And you have a family, and how do you keep all that together? I mean, what are you doing to work on that?
Yeah, I've got two little boys, 6 and 3. My six-year-old said he already knows what he wants to do with his life. He wants to come work for Make You Safe, which is just a cool feeling. I have a wonderful spouse. I've gotten the chance to coach and mentor entrepreneurs as they're just kind of getting started in their journey. And that's one of the things that I talk to them about. If they're married, it's a journey together, right? I have a very supportive spouse. She works full time. She has a good job. That helps provide a safety net for us, especially in these early stages, right? We spent all of our savings to, you know, get this thing off the ground. And I sold my townhome. I did a lot of things to try to get this thing off the ground. But if it wasn't for her support and her ability to earn wage and also to have healthcare benefits and things like that to provide to our family, it would be significantly harder to be able to do something like this. So I've got a good team at home, and that's really been what's allowed me to be able to do this. So she's super supportive of me traveling and being away, and we have to juggle schedules, you know, today to sit down with you and have a chance to hang out. She had to get off work a little early, pick up both boys, you know, and take care of dinner and all that kind of stuff. But she's more than willing to do those kinds of things.
And what does your dad think about it all?
My dad's excited. He's excited to see how far we've gotten. I think he's also he's not a very high tech, you know, type person. It took me quite a while to get him a smartphone. Took me forever to get him on Facebook. I basically said, if you want to see pictures of grandkids, you know, that's where it's going to be. So I don't think he entirely understands the full magnitude of what it is we're doing. He understands the impact that it could have on his business, but I don't think he understands the impact that it can have. Really, what we're talking about is changing the way the world looks at workplace environments and changing the way that we monitor the exposure to our workforce, and that's a global problem. And so I think it'll be even more exciting once he sees things roll out.
So where does the business stand right now? What are you working on right now? You're raising money, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say there's always a capital need.
Sure.
For startups. When I started fundraising, one of my coaches who had raised over $30 million for startups said, just be prepared, because for the rest of your career with this company, you are either going to be fundraising or preparing to fundraise for your next round. And that's turned out to be pretty true. The things that are on the horizon for us are getting through this, what they call MPI process, right? So you go down this journey of going, taking the product from where we are, which is, you know, produced and ready to be mass produced, but you've got to go through a whole process, right? There's certifications and testing that needs to get done, durability testing. How many times can you push the buttons? How many times can you put it in and out of the charging station? How many times will it charge? Then you've got all of the certifications, FCC, UL, you know, depending on what types of environments we want to be, what areas of the world we want to be in, have different certification requirements. So you go through that, all of your tooling for making the product, your contract manufacturing setup and QA. So there's a lot of elements to that. And so that's on the hardware side of things. And then the other side is the business side of things, right? So building out our sales and service and support team. We actually just brought on here a few weeks ago, one of my former business college instructors came on board and joined us full time. So he's the one that helped me start my first company 12 years ago.
Really?
And I reached out to him and said, man, I could really, really use your help. I need to duplicate myself because I'm so focused on, you know, the venture capital side of things. I really could have somebody that can help manage relationships with our insurance customers, help manage relationships with our end users. So he took a break from 28 years of teaching and came on board and joined us full-time about a month ago. So building out that sales and support team, hiring more software developers to continue to develop the software platform and add in some of the elements and ideas that are coming out of our collaboration with the insurance folks and the end users. So that's the foreseeable future for us.
And we're recording this podcast in the office of a venture capital firm, which isn't invested in you, right? And I just witnessed you talking to one of the principals of the firm and giving him an update of maybe the last few months of your work. And so these are just friends. And so one of the things that struck me is, and I've been talking to insurance companies through today on my own business, and a lot of people know who you are, and there's clearly a community here. A real community, a deep community, and a community around innovation and around technology and around doing new things. And it's in insurance and it's in other things as well. I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit. We're running out of time here, so maybe we close on this, on the community that's in Des Moines, Iowa, that's supporting you in all kinds of different direct and indirect ways, and how whether you think you could have done this somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that one of the exciting things that I've seen over the last 5 years is really this emergence of the startup community. It's a very deliberate building of that community by a handful of people that had a good vision. It's, you know, collaboration spaces. It's 1 million cups and some of those types of entrepreneurial events. But it also starts with legislation and some of the things that are done at our state house here, right? There's a tax credit for angel investors, right, to get back 25% of an investment as a tax credit for investing in early stage companies, right? That takes a little bit of risk off of the table. The one area that I think we're probably still really young in here in Des Moines is the venture capital side of things, right? So yeah, we are inside of a venture capital office here. This particular VC focuses on agriculture technology, so really not a direct fit for us. And there's really only a handful of others around the state when it comes to venture capital. And each one of them have kind of their niche and their focus. Some of them, like to follow in on rounds. They don't like to take that lead role and be the lead investor and help, you know, be more of a director for the company. And so I think those are some of the things that we're seeing really emerge here. But if it wasn't for, a lot of those early entrepreneurs taking a lot of steps, you know, shout out to Ben Milne at Dawala, probably the most well-known startup in the ecosystem here in Des Moines, and what he's done in the fintech side of things. But he just, like so many others, really believes that good companies can be started here, can be grown here, and can be exited from here without having to go and move the company off to the coast. And the way I look at it is there's over 6,000 manufacturing companies in my backyard here in the state of Iowa. Des Moines is the second largest insurance capital in America. I mean, we've got a lot of insurance companies headquartered here. It's one of the top professions in Des Moines, right? I don't want to leave and go somewhere else when all of my customers are right here. So it makes sense to build and grow this company here, and we've got a really good community to do it in.
My guest today is Gabe Glynn. Gabe, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.